Our next speaker is Frederick Winter of the U.S. Department of Education.
I should have taken that down, sorry.
Okay, good afternoon. Thank you for sticking with us. Thank you for organizing. Thank you for making this happen. I really, this is an important contribution to the AIA APA, and I'm delighted to have been invited to be part of it. Four things I want to say at the outset. Five. One, I hope the rest of you were also able to be at the more traditional career session that was run yesterday. It was a great program, a wonderful complement to this. I would love to see the two of them more closely meshed maybe in future meetings. I also am going to be using PowerPoint. I'm an archaeologist. It's almost impossible for me to talk without images, but there are really only one or two slides that are important out of this batch, so you know you don't have to worry about the fact that they're there. But, you know, they're there so to allow me to function. I have written out my comments, and I've done it mainly to try and control the 10-minute issue for the presentation. I might run a minute or two over. I've been told that's more or less okay. But this allows me to stick to the time. I apologize, in a sense, for the formality. I also, in a sense, apologize. I'm going to be a little bit pessimistic in my projections about the job market. I think that's the reality of the academic labor situation. The other reality is that you are hearing today that there are other paths that are highly rewarding, appropriate for the degrees, and that we need to consider more deeply as we look at the profession and what being a professional classicist or professional classical archaeologist or being trained in these fields actually mean. And then finally, as a disclaimer, I do have to note that the things that I'm going to say are not an official pronouncement from the Department of Education. That is a requirement of my job once I've been introduced as being part of the agency, which is also appropriate, and that I'm speaking by me and not by a departmental decree or fiat, which I do at other times, but I'm not doing today. Okay, so let me begin with contact information. And an offer to follow up after the conference if you are so inclined. Informational interviews and personal networks are among your best tools for securing non-traditional employment, and I very much encourage you to take advantage of them. Then let me add that in a program on non-traditional careers, at first blush, I am a lousy choice as a speaker. I left the academy to pursue an interest in the federal side of higher education policy after a 20-year campus career with tenure and shortly after I'd been promoted to full professor. My guess is that if tenure and promotion were open to today's PhD recipients, there'd be no perceived need for this session. But that is not the case, as you are probably well aware. So at first blush, I'm a lousy choice, do as I say and not as I did, is a weak predicate for anyone in an advice session such as this one. But on a less superficial level, I hope that I have something to share this afternoon. As the AIA liaison to the joint AIA-APA placement service, I organized the first session on non-traditional careers for our associations, and that was back in 1979. So if you think we're addressing a new phenomenon, you're badly mistaken. What we are experiencing is a persistent endemic situation, and the fact that we're addressing it in the same format today as we did more than 30 years ago suggests that we may need to think about new approaches as to how we perceive career trajectories in our field. I'm getting nods in the front, and I appreciate that. Thank you. I am also, through my current job with the U.S. Department of Education and through my immediate past positions with the Association of American Colleges and Universities and the National Endowment for the Humanities, deeply involved in national issues of higher education policy, which is something I would like to use some of my 10 minutes to examine. We've been asked to begin our presentations by describing our own career paths in the classics. I majored in ancient Greek at Brooklyn College, which you see on the upper left, and then moved on to complete my PhD in classical archaeology, which was at that time a separate department at the University of Pennsylvania down in the lower right. Sounds conventional enough, but in terms of where I ended up, it's also important to note that when I was in high school, I served as an intern in the anthropology department at the Brooklyn Children's Museum, and between college and graduate school, I spent a summer excavating at a prehistoric Polynesian site in Hawaii, and that was the basis for my first academic publication. I was invited back to teach at my alma mater when I was still ABD at Penn, and my path to tenure at Brooklyn College was not without bumps. When budgetary cuts forced interruptions in my pre-tenure position, I used the experience I'd gained at the Children's Museum and in Hawaii, and my archaeological field experience on classical sites overseas to help start and then run the field operations for an archaeological contract firm in New York. Back at the college, I became increasingly involved in campus administrative issues, and I took the grant writing skills I'd developed as a traditional academic researcher and applied them to involving the college in national curriculum programs. When new budget cutbacks on campus precluded my moving into the administration, my involvement in national curriculum issues made it possible for me to move to Washington to fill an opening in the higher education program at the National Endowment for the Humanities. So, a few lessons learned. First, think broadly in terms of your strengths and your interests and your options. I didn't volunteer at the Children's Museum to build career experience in mid-Atlantic archaeology, but that's what happened, and eventually it paid off in terms of career opportunities. I didn't involve Brooklyn College in national curriculum initiatives in order to give myself a national profile in higher education policy, but that happened too, and eventually it led to my being endorsed for the job at NEH. You already have strengths and interests that can lead to fulfilling non-traditional careers. By the way, I'm calling them non-traditional, not alternative. These are not second choices when you want to become a clone of your dissertation advisor. Non-traditional in that we need to recognize new ways that the skills and experience gained in completing advanced degrees in the classics and the humanities more broadly can serve us and serve the country. If you're considering federal employment, where your academic experience in the humanities, your skills as a researcher, and your facility with second and third and fourth language acquisition are highly marketable assets, you need to keep a few points in mind. First, federal job search processes are highly structured. The USA Jobs website, which the front page is up on the screen, is the list of record for all federal job openings, and while it may be cumbersome, it is your gateway. Review the listings regularly. Federal job searches are rigidly formal within most of the civilian agencies. Each position lists KSAs. This is part of the new vocabulary you will gain, knowledge, skills, and abilities. These should be addressed explicitly in the cover narrative that accompanies your application, and you should do this expansively and in each category, even if it makes parts of the narrative seem redundant. The initial vetting for federal positions is done on a point basis, and you want to make it easier for the evaluators of your application to maximize your points in each category. What are the payoffs? You really can make a difference to the multiple campuses and institutions you work with and to the country. Trust me, it feels good. The pay is comparable to campus compensation. Benefits are comparable, too. And when your job is to give away and oversee tens of millions of dollars in federal grants, people are generally nice to you, and that's appealing as well. When I first started at NEH, people kept asking me if I missed teaching, and I came to realize shortly that I was still teaching, except that my students were now deans and provosts. Maybe not as bright as some of the students I'd had at Brooklyn College, but probably more polite and generally more eager to get the class right. And I can still occasionally be involved in the teaching and presentation of classical materials through other teaching options. For example, in my case, I teach courses on a regular basis at the Smithsonian for their adult ed program. So it's not campus teaching. I've decided deliberately not to seek adjunct positions to complement my work in the government because it's just too time consuming. But there are other venues to keep your skills, keep your interest, keep your involvement going. Whoops. Oh, I want to go back. Previous, yes. Vocabulary issue. Okay, fine. Following non-traditional paths for classicists and archaeologists is more common than campus experience might lead us to suppose. My favorite current example is the woman in the slide. Her name is Kimberly Kagan. She has a classics degree from Yale and recently was a senior civilian advisor for military strategy to David Petraeus in Afghanistan. There are lots of other examples. We can talk about some after the session. I've got a list with me, but I just wanted to have Kimberly up there because I think that's so cool. Your academic experience, and we've done this again, but now I know that previous is my magic word. Okay. Your academic experience, which translates into complex reasoning abilities and research capacities, gives you marketable skills for the non-academic world. And surveys conducted over the last decade by the Association of American Colleges and Universities demonstrates that the contemporary business community recognizes this fact. Emerging jobs in this country require higher order skills, and that's exactly what you have to offer. The news isn't perfect, however. The surveys also indicate that a liberal arts degree is more valued by senior executives than by the personnel officers who frequently serve as the gatekeepers for non-academic employment. But that just means you need to circumvent the unimaginative gatekeepers. Informational interviews where you both gain knowledge about a company or industry and simultaneously put yourself on an executive's radar screen are an excellent way to do this. That's the good news. The bad news is that the Academy is transforming itself in a way that is hugely inhospitable to the humanities. Leaving aside the top tier of universities, which will, for the foreseeable future, offer a limited number of career openings for very traditionally focused scholars, the Academy is no longer a realistic option for most new PhD holders in the classics and the humanities in general. A national emphasis on STEM education, that's science, technology, engineering, and math, if you don't have the jargon, and forget, by the way, the occasional talk about STEAM, which adds A to the mix for the arts. It is lip service at best. The increasing vocational focus in higher education and the national short-sighted focus on short-term return on investment for educational initiatives combine to make the Academy an unwelcome job market for anyone in the humanities. Frank Donahue's 2008 account of this in The Last Professors, The Corporate University, and the Fate of the Humanities offers a clear and convincing picture of this depressing economic landscape. And things are not going to get better. Donahue offered his prognostication before the MOOCs hit the Academy. These massive open online courses appear likely to make things much, much harder for people like us. In the emerging MOOC world, one person, the superstar lecturer, may get a traditional academic salary, but when the MOOC courses are distributed to campuses, lots of graders will get only piecework earnings without benefits, without job security, and with salaries well below what even an adjunct can command in today's academic market. This is the nightmare, and it is generally believed to be unavoidable, and there are policy processes in work that are going to try and operationalize this. Are there any solutions? For a start, I think we need to make a much better national case for the value of the humanities and the value of advanced expertise in the fields of the humanities. Various authors have tried to do this recently, most notably Martha Nussbaum in her 2010 essay, Not for Profit, Why Democracy Needs the Humanities. Her take on Socrates is awful, by the way, so don't let that bother you when you read her books. But her central argument about how society needs the perspectives of the humanities and the humanities practitioners' abilities to address complex problems that defy simple solutions and even simple characterizations were right on the money. We also need to redefine the purpose of advanced degrees in the humanities, and I don't just mean by offering suggestions about alternative careers to people who find at the dissertation stage that the Academy doesn't hold employment possibilities. We addressed some of this in the question period earlier, but basically coursework and dissertation topics should reflect a broadened view of legitimate outcomes for humanities education, and anticipated career trajectories should reflect the versatility inherent in advanced degrees and the multiple pathways open to degree holders. Question period will give us a chance, and there's the contact information again if you didn't get it before, to give us a chance to examine our topic in greater detail, as will post-conference conversations, and I very much look forward to both. Thank you. Got my watch in my hand. Well, let's go to the veterans issue, because that's the one I can speak to in more detail, having been on federal hiring panels. You are absolutely correct. In a federal the process for federal employment in the open employment agencies, one applies for a job, the job is posted for a certain amount of time. By the way, let me stand up so you can see me in the back just for the fun of it. I got a phone call last week from someone who I'd worked with through the grants programs when I was at NEH. And the phone call was, gee, I just saw a job listing for a job at the agency. I'd like to talk with you about the job. And I said, do you mean the one that closed today? And she said, yeah. And I said, then why are we having this conversation now? And she said, well, I thought maybe. And I said, no. These are formally structured. You don't shift deadlines, you can't get in under wires, you can't go back around sidebar. So the jobs are listed, they're explicit. The KSAs are things that have to be addressed. Once the KSAs are there, you go to a personnel office. They give you point values based on your response to the KSAs, what they see in the listing of skills. And then based on those points, you are then given a short list, if you're the hiring officer, of who it is who is qualified for the job. You get extra points for veteran service. It is not so much that it guarantees position. Truly is not, in my experience, with any of the jobs that I've been involved in the search on. It does count as extra points. It is reasonable that it would, as a federal return for what you've invested and what you've given to your country. But what we tend to see in the federal job searches is that people who have made a career in the military are often aware of this, and they shotgun apply to jobs for which they are only marginally qualified. I have never seen someone who brought veterans benefits for which they were only marginally qualified get onto that short list for the interviews over people who were actually qualified. Now, on the other side of it, we talked earlier about job tenure and job, you know, sort of, you know, security. Get rid of that. It's okay. You can live without it. Because it's not there. I gave up tenure, went down to the federal government, was going to be vested in my retirement plan in the federal government. A month before my vesting, there was a reduction in force, and I lost my job with the federal government. So I'm a grown-up. I opened a consulting company. The day after I left the government, I had a job consulting. And 6 weeks after that, I was back in the federal government as a term employee consultant. And 5 months after that, in 1 month short of my end of my term, I had a job on a campus as an academic administrator. I mean, you just live without the security, but you don't have to live without the employment. It is there. And where were we starting on this one? With the veterans issue, when the RIF came, the reduction in force came, those people in my agency who had military experience received beneficial points that put them off of the RIF list, and the rest of us who did not went. That's a reality. And again, it's part of the necessary of the structure, but I've not seen unqualified people bounce qualified candidates. On the other hand, if you're thinking about joining the military, this is a benefit that comes after your term of service, that you are preferentially treated within the federal system, and there are benefits that accrue. That's the reality.